Welcome to the Future of Love teleseries presented by Integral Spiritual Experience, Integral Life, and iEvolve, Global Practice Community. The Future of Love dialogues continue this week with John Mackey and Rob Smith dialoguing with Dr. Mark Goffney. John Mackey is chairman and CEO of Whole Foods Market, a $4 billion Fortune 500 company. Rob Smith is the co-founder and CEO of Integral Life and CEO of Integral Institute. And Dr. Mark Goffney is a lineage holder of Kabbalah, a spiritual teacher of world spirituality, and a core founder of iEvolve. In this dialogue, John, Rob, and Mark will explore love and work. Love doesn't need to be limited to the living room, kitchen, or bedroom. It must show up in the office, boardroom, and the mailroom as well. How does love, for example, manifest as an expression of ethics in business? These are the kinds of provocative questions that Dr. Mark will be discussing with John and Rob. It is with much pleasure that we present John Mackey, Rob Smith, and Dr. Mark Goffney.
Welcome, John. Welcome, Rob. It's great to be with you both.
Hey, guys.
Hey, good to be here.
Hey. Okay, and welcome to everyone. You know, there's 10,000 of you awesome listeners who have been with us for, I think, almost 30 weeks now as we've done this really leading-edge journey into the future of love, participating together in the evolution of consciousness, of thinking deeply together in a way which is, you know, not superficial, which is not pop, to really think deeply into the great issues and have this great conversation together. And we have all been looking forward to this particular conversation. I'm going to spend a minute or two creating the context, and then I'm going to, as we've always done throughout the first question, and I'll dialogue with John and Rob about the future of love in a particular context, as we do every week this week. So first, just setting the broader context. This broader series is taking place, as you all know, under the AGs of Integral Life, iEvolve, and we're together thinking about world spirituality, right? The great perennial principles, which understand that when you go deep, right, the deeper you go, you realize there's a common ground of human understanding, of human perception, of human knowing, and that one of the best great secrets of the world is that all of the great traditions that approached reality deeply came up with a certain set of understandings about love, and about work, and about the nature of what is, and about why we're here and where we're going, and about how to live in the uncertainty of what we don't know. And those were the great perennial traditions, and I'm working together with Rob and John, who are actually going to be actually co-chairs of the business section of the Center for World Spirituality based on Integral Principles. Our mega pandit, Ken Wilber, will be a kind of, as he always is, a guiding force in unfolding this. And so as we talk about love today, we're talking about it not from a Christian perspective or from a Jewish perspective or from a Muslim perspective, but from a perspective or a Buddhist or a Taoist or a Native American, but for a perspective which transcends and includes all of them. And by transcend, I mean transcend. We end the trance of one particular understanding. We receive what's best and deepest in it, and we link it with the greatest understandings that exist all over the globe and in all of history. And we're at this place of being able to evolve this great, deeper understanding of knowing in a way that was never actually available before. So that's for everybody listening. That's the context that we're talking about. And we're not going to refer to that anymore today, but that kind of tells us where we are. In that context, from that place, we're talking about love and business, right? Love and commerce, right? Love and capitalism. And when the average person kind of walks down the street and thinks about love, and then to think about business, right? They kind of feel like, what do those two have to do with each other, right? Business, that's profit-driven, isn't it? Isn't that about, you know, making money? Isn't that about accumulating material goods? And love, that's that spirit feeling I have that's all about sacrifice, right? It's all about, right, things that seem to have little to do with the material. So we actually got a few emails from people, you know, this week saying, love and business? Like, what are you guys doing? What's that about? So what's love and business? So we wrote back, well, tune in and listen and find out. So it's delightful to be with you, John, and with you, Rob, and to turn the conversation, to begin the conversation with, you know, what would your response be to those people who have emailed us and said, hey, love and business, you know, what's that about? What is the relationship? How does love, right, actually act and show up in first, second, and third person? Love that you feel first person moving through you. Second person, interpersonal love, love in the space of the we, and third-person love, love as this force, this energy moving the universe, how does that show up in the great world of commerce and business that you're both so involved in? So, John, because you're older than Rob and I, right? We'll start with you, right? And we'll be delighted just to kind of take us into this conversation. Be our teacher.
Okay, Mark. Well, it's sort of an odd question. The question being why, what does love have to do with business or commerce? But there's kind of an assumption about that, that the business and commerce and capitalism are somehow or another not fully human activities. They're held apart in some way. And I think that's part of the problem. We have the the stereotype about business based on metaphors of greed and selfishness, based on this belief that it's all about profit, it's all about money, and therefore it's less than human. And if that's really what business is, then I think people would certainly be right to condemn it. That has not been my experience with business. I think business is as much a human activity as anything else, and humans are engaging in it, so love is appropriate in business. In fact, it's essential to business if it's going to reach its fullest potential.
So say more about that, John. So there's this kind of implicit assumption that exists in the popular street that business is caricatured in some sense at its worst, right, and love at its best. But actually, you're saying actually love, of course, lives in business. Business is one of the natural human activities. Right, and actually, this split between love and business, you're pointing us as a kind of false split. So maybe you could just begin to talk about, from your own personal experience, or from a kind of more meta frame, you know, how does love show up, right, as a force, right, as a deep factor, you know, as you do business?
Well, the first thing to understand is that business is almost always done as community. Meaning a business or a company is it's a group of people that are working together, and they're working together to create value for other people. In fact, the very essence of what business is, which is voluntary exchange, creating value for other people, is not only ethical, but I think if you go deepest to its deepest roots, it's a profoundly loving act, or it can be and it should be. That we care about other people, we're trying to create value for them, and we're cooperating together in order to do that. I see business as fundamentally based on voluntary exchange between people for mutual benefit, that a company has employees that work together, they create value for customers, customers exchange voluntarily with the business, that exchange creates value for the suppliers that are exchanging with the business. It creates value for investors. The whole activity of commerce, when you move away from the caricature and get into it, if you actually have to, if you engage in it, if you create a business, you discover that at the root it's people in community creating value for each other. And that can be and should be a profound act of love and care and compassion.
And what a gorgeous definition of business, just to everyone listening, right? People in community creating value for each other, which is, by its nature, when engaged in appropriately, a profound act of love and caring. All right, thank you. That's gorgeous. Rob?
You know, you mentioned competition, and the only thing that comes to mind as you say that, and I want to underscore how John framed it, which is that, you know, business people are competing for the right to improve humanity. And that's actually what the competitive act is all about. When you and I are in a relationship to each other, whether we're exchanging money or we're exchanging time or we're exchanging love or we're exchanging energy, to some degree we are in community trying to say that we're worth exchanging that with each other around. And business people are trying to create these communities of value production in a way that says, look, you know, I want to have the right to improve humanity in this way. And this way might be, you know, a fantastic organic grocery chain of healthy foods the way John has built. Or it might be, you know, great, fully and free life media the way Integral Life is trying to compete. But ultimately, everyone has to decide what's right for them. And so I think there's something actually very liberating and deeply nourishing about the notion that in this community of exchange and in this community of loving exchange, we get to sort of bring our best self forward and offer our most creative instincts about what can move humanity forward. And on a macroeconomic basis, I mean, I guess I would just point out that arguably the greatest improvement in human suffering in absolute terms in human history has occurred in the last 50 years because we've brought 3 billion people out of abject poverty through the globalizing force of business. Now, that has downsides, and you know, we can certainly talk about those, but from just a pure sort of alleviating suffering point of view, it's just a profound testament to what is capable when we all, as a community of humanity, come together and compete for the right to improve each other's life conditions.
Yeah, that's wonderful, Rob. And I mean, it's just an incredible, just to hear it, you know, just to hear this, which we're kind of vaguely aware of, but to hear 3 billion people brought out of poverty by, you know, love disguised, you know, as the capitalist impulse, you know, through the means of globalization, right? It's just an awesome thing to hear. And that, you know, that makes globalization, you know, the greatest church in history, you know. And so that's kind of an awesome. But let me before we go there, which I want to talk a lot more about that, let me play, you know, the devil's advocate for the man on the street for a second, you know, Rob and John. And John, I'll come back to your distinctions immediately. Okay, so I'm the man on the street. And now we know that the man or woman.
We have a devil's advocate in a talk on love here.
Right, exactly. We need a devil always in a talk on love for sure. So here I am, and we know that the popular superficial understandings, you know, of everything, you know, leave a lot to be desired. And my teacher once said many years ago, the opposite of the holy is the superficial. So, and we know that the blogosphere is filled with, you know, radical irresponsibility. So let's give the man on the street not too much authority, but let me just kind of phrase a question for him, her, for a second. When we hear about a great deal, right, I remember when my grandmother would talk about a ganze Mitzia in Yiddish, right, a great deal. So what's a great deal? So the way people usually understand a great deal is you give the least and you get the most, right, which is a very narrow understanding of a great deal. Right, which is kind of where this image of this caricatured false ismus of a kind of business being very narrow and almost greedy kind of emerges from. So perhaps, John, let me turn to you. Redefine for us, you know, in a higher context in which love is at play, what is for you a great deal?
Well, the first thing about that particular metaphor that you used or example that you used, that sort of assumes the idea that people will not continue to exchange with each other. That I got a great deal, meaning I won and he lost, and isn't that great? And first of all, people exchange for mutual benefit, and it's voluntary exchange. So chances are good, even if you assume that you got a good deal, the other person might have felt like they got a good deal.
Right.
It doesn't have to be zero sum. It can be win-win. But
right.
In many instances, if someone gets a better deal and the other person feels like they later on that they got cheated, well, if there are going to be any repeat exchanges between those two, the person who felt like they got taken advantage of or cheated is going to be bitter and resentful. And you're harming your long-term relationship. And so I have found in business, and when we're talking about love in business, that it's much better in all your exchanges to try to create the win-win-win scenario where people are all gaining from the exchange. And so I want the people I exchange with to feel good about the exchange, to feel like they are getting a good deal, because we want to have ongoing relationships with them. First of all, we want them to be happy, because that's a good in and of itself. But we also think it's mutually good for the business, because we want to have an ongoing long-term relationship with those customers, with those suppliers, with those team members, with those investors. So it's good for business to be empathetic and to look out the good of all of the people that it's in relationship with, because that's in the best interest of the people that you're exchanging with, but it's also in the best interest of the business itself. So I truly believe that business has the potential, and it's about creating win-win-win strategies where everyone is flourishing and everyone is benefiting.
And so to say it really simply, I mean, that was a completely fantastic answer and completely appreciated. What John's essentially saying, everyone, is that this caricature of a great deal is really a really bad deal, right? Because it's extremely narrow, right, in its frame of time, meaning just that immediate moment. It doesn't have a meta perspective. It doesn't have a long-term trajectory. And so it's kind of an unconscious bad deal disguised as a good deal in the short-term ego gratification, right? So that's a big distinction. That's a really helpful distinction.
A bad deal really is a good deal.
Right. A bad deal is not a good deal.
The other thing that I would bring forward, Mark, here is the evolutionary perspective, which is to say, you know, when you're 16 years old, your definition of love is obviously very it's very romantic, but it's also somewhat self-centered. I mean, even though we don't think of it as such when we're 16. The reality is our reference frame is very narrow about, you know, this is what this person represents to me, and I get very possessive of it. Now, obviously, that definition and that enactment of love changes a lot by the time you get married, and even then, over the 30 or 40 or 50 years you're married, it grows and expands to the point where it becomes very much like a cosmic commitment, a perception of love, as you would say. So I think from an evolutionary point of view, it's important we recognize that relational exchange is going to have some of that same kind of growth related to it. And it's the person that's saying, I got a great deal, and is thinking in zero-sum terms, you know, their definition of success may be equivalent to the 16-year-old. Whereas, you know, the conscious leadership that John and I and others are working on at Conscious Capitalism is really trying to bring forward more of the, you know, sort of 60-year-old perspective on love and relational exchange, and saying, look, actually, at the leading edge of business, what we need are leaders who can think about world-centric sort of, you know, wins for everybody, a multiple stakeholder approach to business. And that's really what John was just referring to.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so let's jump into Conscious Capitalism. I mean, let's just start there and kind of, you know, so you throw out Robson, which a lot of our listeners are not familiar with. And again, my job here on this call is not to be in the kind of, you know, Oxford philosopher or spiritual teacher mode, which I live in other times, but to make sure that the beautiful things that, you know, John and Rob are saying don't get lost here. So Rob just threw something out, Conscious Capitalism. And a lot of people are saying to themselves right now, what's that? Right, so John, Rob, tell us a little bit. You're both involved in a movement. I think you were, you know, started, you know, with a number of other people, you know, together a bunch of years ago. Conscious Capitalism. And again, there we have these two words together that don't often appear in the same place. And so, just in putting them in a sentence together, you're correctly overcoming the polarity between consciousness on the one hand, right, and capitalism on the other hand. So John, Conscious Capitalism. What's that?
Well, it's exactly what I've been talking about so far.
Okay.
And we tend to, first of all, you've got to make a distinction perhaps between conscious capitalism and conscious business. And conscious capitalism would be becoming more aware of the elements of that make up for capitalism in a way that is performed in an ethical way, free trade, freedom of exchange, property rights, those type of underlying economic truths that undergird capitalism. Conscious business is what we mostly talk about when we talk about conscious capitalism, and that is business that, A, is in touch with its higher purpose or its deeper purpose that goes beyond just making money and making profits and maximizing shareholder value. Not that there's anything wrong with those, but that's just a very narrow definition of business, which a business can have a higher purpose, and it needs to come to understand what that is to become conscious of it. The second principle would be the stakeholder philosophy, understanding that business is these exchanges that business makes, that you have a group of stakeholders, customers, employees, suppliers, investors, communities, and the larger environment, that are all interdependent upon one another. And so in a conscious business, you come to understand the relationships that exist between those interdependent stakeholders, and you manage the business in such a way as to optimize value for all of those stakeholders and not just one particular stakeholder, such as the investors. Mm-hmm. Thirdly, you have leadership that is not in it strictly for themselves, that is leadership that's conscious and tries to fulfill the purpose of the business, manages with a stakeholder philosophy. And the fourth part of it is you create a culture in the business or the organization that reflects the purpose. You set up strategy, structures, and processes that reinforce the purpose and reinforce the stakeholder philosophy and helps produce conscious leaders. That's kind of it in its most abstract but succinct.
So let's start there. That's four. I mean, John just laid out for us, you know, four very, very clear, you know, kind of directions. And let's touch in, you know, John, with you and with Rob on each one of those. Let's start with number one. So John starts with, right, a business, conscious business, and kind of making that distinction between the more meta frame of conscious capitalism. Conscious business is to be a business to be in touch with its higher purpose. Now, of course, we're used to hearing about purpose, you know, in the general religious community, right? Rick's book, Warren, great book, Purpose-Driven Life, from a kind of fundamentalist Christian perspective. From a more integral perspective, you know, Ken and I have been talking about, together with Rob, this thing we call unique self, right, living your unique self. So you're suggesting that a business, right, has a higher purpose, which is beyond the important accomplishments of being, you know, solvent and creating, you know, simple, important, critical economic value. And just to say clearly to everyone, economic value is a big deal. Human dignity is directly linked up with having simple economic needs met. And as Maslow pointed out, if your safety needs, right, if your survival needs aren't met, there's nothing you can do in higher consciousness. So let's establish as a given that's a great good for the business to be, you know, solvent and to pay its employees and to create value. But you're pointing to a kind of higher purpose for a business. You said a business would be in touch with its higher purpose. So tell us, you know, John and then Rob, more about that. What does it mean for a business to create a higher purpose beyond its kind of classically understood bottom line?
You know, one of the best ways to get for people to understand how business can have a higher purpose is to think about the not-for-profit sector of our society.
Mm-hmm.
Think about not-for-profit sector. We come to understand that those organizations are created for, they're not there primarily to make money, right? So they exist for some deeper, higher purpose.
Mm-hmm.
We understand that in most professions, doctors, their deeper purpose would be, or higher purpose would be, to heal sick people.
Right.
Teachers, to educate people. And it's funny that we only think of business as somehow or another less than fully human, not having
right.
any purpose other than simply a money machine.
Right.
It's that's ultimately disrespectful, and it's just not.
It's not loving.
It's not loving. It's very
right.
much.
It's not loving.
It isn't.
Not even accurate.
So. I wouldn't pretend to say what any other business's deeper purpose or higher purpose is. That's something that has to be discovered or created by the people who have created the business or are leading the business or are the stakeholders that are invested in the business. I can say Whole Foods is continuing to discover its deeper purpose or higher purpose. And in our case, it's selling the highest quality natural and organic foods in the world, trying to help people to reach their highest potentiality in terms of their health and well-being through healthy eating education. I can talk about our team members being self-actualized and reaching their fullest potential as human beings. I can talk about our commitments to our communities. And it's getting in touch with all of that. And if we try to get to the very deepest levels, you get into almost Platonic ideals, the good, the true, the beautiful, perhaps
mm-hmm.
the heroic. And I think a business, as it goes on a discovery of who it is, just like an individual has to discover what their higher purpose is. A business, in a sense, is merely it's a collection of individuals that are working together, usually in pursuit of some higher and deeper purpose. And they're on a journey together. It's an adventure. It can be great fun. And so I do think purpose energizes people, and you get the higher part of you, human potential flourishes best in organizations that are activated by purpose. And it has to be authentic. It has to be genuine purpose. But when it's there, better human flourishing occurs. And so it's to create 21st century organizations that humans flourish in business, it's essential that businesses become more conscious of what their purpose is. why they exist and what they're trying to do in the world. And they should look to the not-for-profit sector as teachers in this regard, because the not-for-profit sector is much more in touch with purpose as a general rule than the business side of things. But it doesn't have to be that way.
That is just, I mean, that's just a nuanced and just such a helpful and great response. So just thank you for that. And I just have to, there's so much that you said. I'm going to turn to you, Rob, in a second. I just want to just make a Whole Foods comment, you know, a man from the street. When Rob, Ken, and I have been working on this unique self idea, which is kind of our revisioning of the next step of kind of individual development, I needed a place to sit and write, John. And I don't like writing at home. I've always historically written in cafes. So I used to write in cafes in Jerusalem, and I was living in Salt Lake City when I was writing, and I couldn't find a place to write where the writing was flowing. And so I went to the Whole Foods near me. This is absolutely true. And for whatever reason, sitting in the space that they had, right, something felt good about the subtle energy in the store. And subtle, I'm a mystic scholar activist, so I get to talk about subtle energy. It's a real thing. Something felt right in the store. And I actually sat and wrote most of the Unique Self book, right, about to come out in Whole Foods, right, because I actually felt good, right, in the environment there, not because just people smiled, but because you actually felt something in the subtle energy, which you've actually just explained, that there's something in the root, right, of Whole Foods, which is about this higher purpose and all the ways you expressed it. And I just want to share with you just from the street that you actually can feel it in the store. And that's just a gorgeous thing. So a thank you for everybody, you know, who kind of enjoys, right, what you're offering there, you know, for kind of creating that kind of context.
I just want to underline that because it's funny you say that, Mark. I actually do some of my best writing as well sitting in my Whole Foods down the street.
See, John, you thought it was about food. It's actually creating a place for writers.
See, John, I'm going to have to start. We're going to have to start getting some royalty checks from you guys.
Start charging.
Absolutely. Rob, take it away, brother. Rob, what's higher purpose, right, playing off of just that beautiful unfolding from John? What's to be in touch with a higher purpose? You're now putting together, you know, a big move in business, which is, I think, not talkable about in public, so I won't. But you're thinking about higher purpose a lot now. So what's that mean for your higher purpose in business?
Yeah, it's a great question. So just like in Unique Self, we talk about the layers at which you discover your unique self, right, your unique calling. And there's no time, I think, which you wake up and say, oh, that's it. Now all of the evolutionary process, the developmental process is over, right? I mean, that day just doesn't come. It's a constant unfolding, a constant deepening. I think the purpose for a business, as John pointed to, and the purpose for an entrepreneur is actually much the same. And actually the purpose for every person in their own lives. So I think this is where the boundary line between, you know, business as this artificial construct and us just as human beings in our spiritual quest to find meaning and to live a good life and to be committing ourselves to something that's higher than us, bigger than us, and be in service, this is where those boundary lines begin to blur pretty quickly. I was teaching an MBA course the other night on entrepreneurship, and I asked the 30 kids in the room, you know, what do they want to do with their lives to give them a happy death? And this happy death concept, something I talk about a lot. And it's the notion of tapping into your uniqueness and really giving it your all so that you can look back and say, yeah, that was, I left it all on the playing field. And, you know, of the 30 answers, not a single one said, I want to make a lot of money, right? That was not where the drive comes from. It was things in clean energy. It was things in technology. It was things in healthcare. So there was always some motivating, loving, contributory instinct or drive that allows them to come from the heart to, you know, give them the happy death. That's the motivating instinct for all great businesses. And as both an entrepreneur and as an investor that supports other entrepreneurs, that's always what we look for, because that's the passion that not only drives them to sort of, you know, shift reality when reality doesn't want to shift, because, you know, creating a new product or a new market or new whatever takes a lot of energy, and it takes a lot of sort of stubbornness almost. So you have to have that passion to keep you up during the long nights. But it's also important because that's where actually your team will feel inspired from, where your investors will say, yeah, that's the person I want to back because I know they're on mission. So I'd say, you know, to make sort of a crude love baby here, it's like Unique Self is a huge strategic strategic advantage. It's a huge competitive advantage in terms of bringing your vision forward for the right to improve humanity.
That's completely awesome. And as I've spent, as Rob knows, about the last 25 years of my life, you know, arguing with the Enlightenment community, and I think we're finally succeeding in changing the conversation all over the world, that Enlightenment's not about losing, right, your sense of individuality. It's not about becoming part of the seamless code of the universe and disappearing, but the seamless code of the universe is seamless. It's not featureless, and there's a personal face to essence, and God lives, right, you know, whatever God means, the God you don't believe in doesn't exist. But God lives in you, as you, and through you uniquely, right, in a way that doesn't happen ever, never has happened, never will happen. And this is your watch. This is your moment. And as that's true for a person, it's true for a business, right? And that's this higher purpose that John and Rob are talking about. Now, before I turn to John with the next question, as we go through the four dimensions, you know, of a higher vision of conscious business, you know, and Rob talks to us about the evolutionary unfolding. It's always happening, right? Says Rob. You're not done. It's evolving, you know, from 16 to 50 to 90, you know, it all happens. So we're going to talk also about that evolutionary piece. But before all of that, I just have to make a stand, you know, with these two gentlemen for money. You guys are dumping on money a lot, you know, so I just want to be clear, you know, as a poor spiritual teacher, you know, money's not such a bad thing, right? And and actually, right, you know, of course, John and Rob aren't dumping on money. What they're saying is that's not the goal, you know, but money itself, you know, the ability to actually have enough to move beyond your survival needs is by itself a huge contribution. And capitalism produced one thing in the world, in its shadows, communism didn't work. And it would be well from an integral perspective, all of us listening, to remind ourselves that actually people who are creating successful businesses that create jobs, that allow people to move beyond survival needs, that by itself, before we even got into any other discussion of any higher context, that by itself is a huge act of love. That's a huge act of love. That's like this awesome love. And that's the love you were talking about, Rob, that's lifted 3 billion people out of poverty, you know, and the 57,000 people that work in John's framework, right, that live a dignified life, can then actualize their consciousness in a whole other way. So let's just hold that, everyone listening. So now we're going to go to number two. So
Mark,
John,
quick comment on that.
Go right in.
I mean, money is, of course, one of the things people are most confused about whenever you get into one of these discussions. And, of course, money is not the only goal, but it's one of the goals of business. It's a good thing, as you pointed out and Rob pointed out. Money is, and profit is how we are eliminating poverty on this planet. I mean, people don't realize that 200 years ago, 85% of the people alive on the planet Earth lived on less than a dollar a day. Today, it's only 20%. Now, that's still 20% too many people, and poverty is still a horrible thing that needs to be eliminated, and I think will be eliminated. But from a historical perspective, we've made great progress, and I believe we will continue to make great progress if we continue to trade with each other and intellectual and financial capital continue to multiply. So money is a good thing. When I say that's not the deepest purpose of business, I sincerely mean that, but that doesn't mean that somehow their money can be ignored. One of the challenges that not-for-profit organizations have, if they can teach the for-profit sector about purpose, the for-profit sector can teach the not-for-profit sector about financial discipline and about the value of money and not wasting it. Sometimes it's not enough just to have high ideals and a higher purpose. You have to be able to actualize it in the world. You have to have the skill sets and the discipline to manage the capital and the money that your organization's entrusted with in such a way that you can multiply it, to be a good steward of it. So, anyway, I wanted to make that comment.
The way I'd say it, Mark, just maybe as a sort of a metaphor, is the body doesn't exist so it can breathe, right? I mean, that's not the body's deeper purpose. That's not the deeper purpose of our life, is so it can breathe. But if you cut down the oxygen in your room by 50%, you're going to find yourself sort of gasping on the floor, hoping for oxygen. The point is, oxygen is necessary to keep the body functioning, and money is the same way. So money is a necessary and important measure of what is allowing for these complex ecosystems we call business, and actually society and civilization at large, to function in more and more flourishing ways. that doesn't mean that we should make the move to reduce the purpose of those to that necessary input.
Yeah, no, completely received, Rob. And I just want to say for the record here, because I don't want to affect the stockholder price of either Whole Foods or your new venture, Rob, just on the record, John Mackey and Rob Smith are both in favor of money. That would be a bad rumor to get out. These guys are anti-money. So we've corrected that here. So let me just you know, say one other thing about this and then turn to the next question in terms of the four pieces that you outlined, John, in terms of what conscious business means. And this is time to kind of have some confessions here. And the Oxford scholar confesses to a deep, dark secret. I spend 3 years in business. Here we go. So in those three years, and Rob, you know this, we were involved in buying high-tech companies, restructuring them, and taking them public when I was 30, 31. And I really wanted to know, what is it like to actually live not as a spiritual teacher? How does the rest of the world live? Like, what do they do? And I found very strangely in those 3 years that paradoxically, as much as the spiritual world talks about, you know, kind of clarity and purity, of course, the spiritual world is itself filled with, you know, motives of greed and ego and agendas and all the human weaknesses that fill every place. And I paradoxically found the business world that I was in for those 3 years very clean. It was very clean. It was very above board. You know, we were making a product. The product either worked or didn't work. It either helped people or didn't. And there were kind of invisible laws, if you will, to borrow an old term, right, of the marketplace that somehow or another affected our quality. So there's actually something, I found something very, just from a kind of personal, first-person experience, something enormously clean about those 3 years. They were very disclosing of their agenda. They were very clear. There wasn't a lot of subterfuge. So I think that's something that's just kind of worth saying. You know, business, when conducted in the right way, is just an enormously clean and clear activity without a lot of hidden layers. Does that strike you guys as resonant in any way?
It strikes me as relevant, but you're not the first person to be surprised that way. Abraham Maslow, when he did his research, he was very surprised to find that business people had a higher rate of self-actualizers than most other parts of society. And when, I can't pronounce his name, but the author of Flow and Good Business.
No one can, John, Michael, whatever.
when he studied the people that were in flow states, he found a very, that a higher than average percentage were in business. So the stereotypes that people have that are outside of business are, again, somewhat caricatures from academia, from the university, and from the media, who both oftentimes are hostile towards business and aren't fair to it in the sense of trying to really understand it. But those that are in it discover that, guess what, human beings are in business, and they have real communities, and they're fully human beings. They love, they fear, they are generous, they're kind, they sometimes feel guilty.
And they're heroic and beautiful.
They can be. They often are.
Yeah, they can be heroic and beautiful. And that's one of the, you know, kind of one of the things that the kind of theme running through this whole conversation, you know, as we go forward, is to actually undermine that caricature from an integral perspective and actually realize that business is not just, as John says, human, but it's one of the places that we can actually realize the fullest potential of our humanity, living in the full eras of what it means to be a human being.
Mark,
so
this is where I want to point out the data that's coming out of the neuroscience research field that is showing that the act of relational exchange, which of course goes back for millennia into our sort of prehistorical roots and perhaps even further, is the foundation of empathic development. It's the foundation of why we've developed the capability for empathy, and that it's directly related to the production of oxytocin in our systems. And if anybody's interested, you can look at Paul Zak's research on this, and there are others. The point is that what you said about the cleanliness of being in business, there's actually a really good reason for that, and that's because in a competitive marketplace of ideas where everybody's acting with a certain degree of autonomy, you actually can't afford to not be empathic in a way that's taking into account the perspective of the other, how they're looking at the world, what is their view of benefit, what's their view of value, what's important to them. And if you disrupt that, if you're not trustworthy, if you're underhanded too many times, then the marketplace is very efficient at basically, you know, keeping you from succeeding in your own sense of what you're trying to accomplish. And so for me, what you said resonates 100%, but I actually think it's supported very much by the data. And I would argue that relational exchange, that is what we know as business, is probably one of the most powerful forces of human development that we have.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I mean both John's comments and yours put together, Rob, are just they open up space for a person just to kind of feel directly into, right, the inner experience of commerce man, right? You know, as this full and potentially, you know, heroic, beautiful, and noble human being. So let me now, I'm going to take my moderator's job now, not my dialogue job, and I want to go back, John, to the four dimensions of consciousness you outlined, and to bring everyone back to this part of the conversation, we talked about being in touch with a higher purpose, and John and Rob have commented on that, and John outlined three other dimensions. One was the interdependence, if I recall, of stakeholders, that all the stakeholders are interdependent, and you need optimum value for all of them. That was two. Three was, I believe, leadership being conscious, right? And four was creating a culture, right, that puts into place, I think you said, the strategies, structures, purpose. You create a kind of culture that reflects that higher purpose. So I want to start with number four, all right, John, because you've had a lot of experience. You've got an enormous amount of wisdom. You've done it, right? You've actually incarnated it, of creating a culture within Whole Foods, right, which reflects this higher vision. So what does it mean? How do you create a culture? I know that's a big question. I know there's a lot of doors in. Any door in works for us. How have you created a culture reflecting the higher purpose within the structure of Whole Foods? Is that a fair question?
Sure, it's a fair question. We'll run out of time before I finish, so.
Perfect.
No, but seriously, you have to create a culture that its strategies, its structures, and its processes reinforce the higher purpose of the business, or the purpose will be just talk, and it'll be something that consultants put on a piece of paper but isn't a lived reality within the organization. So the culture is very important. And I can talk about some of the things Whole Foods has done that have reinforced our purpose, but I do think, in a sense, culture is unique to the organization, and one size doesn't fit all, so I don't pretend that what I'll talk about is necessarily can be universalized. But some of the things we've done that have really helped us. One is we're organized into teams, and the teams are self-managing, and everyone's on a team. And the teams are they're interlocking with each other, meaning they go all the way up from the stores all the way to the highest levels within the company, and the teams are and they're also, the company's highly decentralized, which is another principle. We've got some of it's centralized, but a great deal of it is decentralized. The teams at the store level are therefore authentic, real communities of people. They self-select their own teammates to become a member of the team. You have your own probationary period. It requires a two-thirds vote by your peers to become a full member of the team. Our compensation reinforces that because the more productive the team is, the more money each of the teams makes, and we reward the team as a group rather than as individuals. So this empowers the team to be careful and selects. Am I still there, Mark?
You are. You're with us.
I'm afraid that my battery might be running down here. The teams are empowered, and the compensation reinforces that. Some of the other things we do, we have a commitment to our team member happiness. We've created structures and processes that lead to individual flourishing. The philosophy being that if the team members aren't really happy in their work, they're not going to take care of the customers. If the customers aren't happy, then the business isn't going to flourish, and the investors won't be happy. So we've made team member happiness one of our core values, and we are constantly strategizing within the stores, but within all the way up to the most senior levels, how can we help our team members to be happy? How can we empower them? How can we train them? How can we help them reach their highest potential as individuals and also to serve our customers? So part of what you're feeling when you're in the store, when you said you were writing in the store and you enjoyed it, you're feeling that type of energy that our team members and customers are sort of co-creating. So you've got teams, you've got compensation. We give stock options to everyone. We have a salary cap of 19 times the average pay. That's had to go up over the years because some of our people get hired away by our competitors, so we've had to raise it. But it's still very modest by large corporation standards. We have open books, so what everybody gets paid is public information. That helps create, I think, a greater sense of fairness and justice. You know, everyone gets paid. You have less nepotism and unfairness that way. Stock options for everyone that work in the company, and there's just a huge variety of ways that we are dedicated. Our Whole Planet Foundation is our outreach to the larger global community through microcredit loans. That's been incredibly fulfilling for our team member base as we do that. Our healthy eating education initiatives, I could go on and that for a lengthy period of time, how we're trying to help our team members to be as healthy as possible, to reach their fullest potential in terms of health and vitality. And we have incentive discount cards based on your biometrics, how you measure your that's something we've created in the last year in order to encourage and incent our team members by giving them bigger discounts as they're able to lower their cholesterol, lower their blood pressure, lose weight, quit smoking. So we're incenting them to be as healthy as possible. That's a great example of a strategy that's also a win-win strategy because obviously healthier team members mean we'll spend less money on their health care.
Right.
And they will be more productive in the workplace as well. So it's voluntary.
Wow.
We're not coercing anyone, but it's a strategy. It's a process that reinforces that interdependent stakeholder nature.
And that is a gorgeous, what's great about this is that's not a gorgeous vision you unfolded, it's a gorgeous reality, right, that's actually in place, and happening, on all levels of reality. And that's just utterly fantastic and a delight. And I have a number of places I want to kind of go deeper and double click. But before that, I'm going to turn to you, Rob, and just give us your sense of this.
Yeah, the data is very clear that an engaged workforce is one of the things that's driving or not driving well-being globally. It's actually quite astounding what the research is showing that career well-being, work well-being is actually the number one most important factor in overall life well-being, whether somebody feels like they're thriving or not. And for workers who feel like they're disengaged from their work, depression rates are twice as high. They're twice as likely to be diagnosed with depression. So the idea of a conscious culture is absolutely critical to when we think about love, we think about well-being, we think about people thriving. It's critical that we get conscious cultures online. John's pointing to what the conscious culture at Whole Foods looks like. There's a couple of other things I'd point out. One is that for a worker to feel engaged, for me or anybody when they go to work, what we need to do is we need to feel like we're committing to something bigger than ourselves. That's number one of the most important factors is either a deeper purpose or a deeper mission, bigger than myself, and second, that I'm playing to my strengths at work. If I feel like I'm playing to my strengths at work and I'm drawing on my strengths rather than my vulnerabilities, if I'm constantly being reminded of my vulnerabilities, then I'll be dragged into a place where I don't feel engaged, I don't feel like I'm thriving. So those two factors are really, really big. And the third one, which John could spend a lot of time talking about, but we've also been doing this at Integral Life, is around core values. Having an organization which is maniacally dedicated to the core values being the fundamental sort of lodestone around its own behavior, and those core values being articulated, being set out, and from the CEO down saying these are the ways we make decisions. If these core values act as guides to behavior. And what's interesting about it is that that's actually not that different from, our home life or our marriages or the way we operate in society at large. We have core values, but we just don't go through the process of articulating them. Well, work is no different, and I think that's what the learning that conscious businesses and conscious capitalism are bringing online for folks is the importance of these elements.
That's completely fantastic, Rob. I just have to note, before we go on, I like your positive deployment of the word maniacally. That's a hard word to deploy positively. maniacally dedicated to core values is awesome. So let's just take a look for a second. And I want to go back and I want to circle back from that place to John, what you talked about this commitment. You listed 8 or 9 different things. and I jotted them down in my head, but one of them, I think number 4 or 5, was this commitment to the happiness of our workforce, right? And that the team members are actually happy, right, is actually a big deal. And it's very clear that you're talking about happiness here, not in that superficial sense again, right? You know, not in the sense of, okay, I got better stock options, now I'm happy. It's happiness in this broader sense, Rob, that you're bringing to the table together with John, that happiness in some senses, we talk about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But, of course, all the great traditions point out you can't pursue happiness because it always runs away, that happiness is only available, based on the passionate pursuit of something other than happiness, and happiness is a byproduct of that. So that other, Rob, you talk about core values. You talk about, committed to something larger than yourself. You talk about playing to your strengths. So we might almost say that happiness is a byproduct of, feeling like you're living your unique story.
That's right.
That you're actually,
exactly
it's a byproduct of unique self-living. That's exactly what it is. And so I want to ask
it's
you
unique self-work, Mark. It's unique self-work.
Unique self-work, right.
Yeah.
Unique self-work, exactly. So in that sense, I want to ask one specific question to you, John, because everything you said popped out and there were a million ways to go. But you talked about the Whole Planet Foundation, right, doing microcredit loans. And if I understood correctly, it was like a passing phrase. It seems to me that the employees are actually involved in the distribution of those loans. Was that right, wrong?
I'm not sure that's what I exactly said, but they are. We do have a volunteer program that allows our team members to volunteer to go down into some of these communities. We're not now in 19 countries making microcredit loans, working with Grameen, Muhammad Yunus's Grameen Trust, and with Grameen like Replicator. So it's kind of like our own little internal Peace Corps. We take very young team members, very young idealistic team members. They go down, not for long periods of time, about 30 days at a time, and they're volunteering their time. And it's. I've met a lot of those team members who've come back, and their lives have been totally changed. They've never seen really hardcore poverty up close before.
And that's part of the fabric of Whole Foods. That's awesome.
This is an example of evolving purpose, so maybe I can use it to illustrate. Well, we've always felt like we had that part of our deeper purpose or higher purpose was to be good citizens in our communities. So wherever our stores are, we thought, well, our community is our stores. And so we've always been very philanthropic. We give 5% of our net profits away to the local not-for-profit organizations in the communities that we're in. So we're supporting thousands of organizations. But we began to ask the question, do we have any responsibility to the communities that we trade in around the world, since we're doing business all over the world? And we came back with the answer when we asked that question is, yeah, we think we do. And then we started to work with Grameen Trust regarding microcredit loans, first ones in Costa Rica, then we went to Guatemala. Now we're all over Africa, Asia, South America, Central America, with the goal being, and we're doing these exchanges in the communities that we actually trade in. So we're not just doing it randomly in a place like Costa Rica or Guatemala, but actually where we're trading. We're getting coffee in Guatemala or bananas in Costa Rica. And so it was that sense that what is our obligation, what is our responsibility to the larger global community that where we're trading? And when the answer came back, we have a responsibility, we should be involved, then it just sort of flowed, and that's all occurred in the last 5 years. So we weren't doing this before. So I think the company's purpose can evolve over time. It unfolds to higher and higher levels or deeper and deeper possibilities. So you don't just go up on a mountaintop and figure out your purpose once and for all. The purpose of Whole Foods today has evolved. It's very different today than it was 30-plus years ago when we first created it. Our purpose has continued to evolve, just like an individual's purpose in life can evolve over time. I think there's kind of a collective purpose of an organization that can evolve.
The Whole Planet Foundation
is a good example of it.
That's awesome. I mean, there's like a unique, and it's Whole Foods has a unique self, if you will.
That's
is that
correct.
A fair way? And which is evolving.
Yeah,
and it's different than the unique self of the limited.
There is a collective intelligence, a collective mind, a collective heart. Now, I don't mean in an organic sense, there is the relationships that exist between these interdependent stakeholders. There is, but it's also more than just metaphorical. There is, in a sense, a Whole Foods Market self, And business tries to get at that sometimes by talking about brand. But brand is a very poor substitute for what I'm talking about. It's sort of mechanical. It's part of the industrial age. I would think it's a higher collective self that the organization manifests. And I try to serve that. It's humbling in a way because as one of the co-founders, I'm oftentimes thought of as the father of the company. But Whole Foods has grown way beyond the father, and it has its own life. It has its own spirit. Just like in a biological sense, a parent can help guide their children when they're young, but eventually the children grow up and they have a life on their own that's apart from their parents. I think a company is similar to that, and that Whole Foods is now 30-plus years of age, and it has its own life. It has its own destiny. I can influence it, and I'm proud of it, but it sometimes goes in ways I wouldn't necessarily wish it would go.
And for a father to love their child is to allow the child to choose and to kind of honor that higher choice, even at moments when it doesn't reflect the particular direction of the father.
Exactly.
That's part of love.
Exactly.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And Rob, that was just we'll be the commentators here. I mean, just there's so much that you said. And Rob, I would just love to hear from your experience this image. And let me just pick one up of five pearls. You know, Whole Foods as a kind, Whole Foods market self. That's a question. There's a Whole Foods market self, and that self has its own identity, which is more than just a corporate character. It's a kind of collective intelligence of heart, of mind, and it's always evolving. It's always evolving. So that's a unique self at the level of the corporation, right? As you know, it's the interior face of brand. Brand is just the kind of the flatland expression of it, as you will. But it's this pulsating. Brand is a great reduction of this depth that you're describing.
To be integral geeky about it, what we're talking about here is the ontology of the lower left, the ontology of the culture, it's a real thing, as we know. It's a very, very real texture, and it does evolve, and that lower left it doesn't have anything we can point to sort of out there, but it lives within us if we're part of the meaning-making community that is involved in that intersubjective culture. And what the brand is doing is it's a signifier that sort of reminds us of that feeling. Now, good brands remind us of all of that richness. Bad brands remind us of, maybe none of the richness, or they actually remind us of the wrong thing. So the brand is just a signifier as a sort of an access point to the richness of the lower left. And, of course, some companies don't actually have that richness. They actually stand for the wrong things. And so they wonder why their brands are not great. And it's like, well, because from the ground up, you haven't actually embodied the cultural aspects that are going to allow you to stand for great things.
That's completely fantastic. And this is just what comes to mind in the moment. I want to just kind of bring it down to you, Rob, to you, John. Right, when we talk about unique self and the work we've done over the last, 2.5 decades, right, you talk about three levels. You talk about ego, the egoic personality, right, which is kind of the ultimately fear-driven, where there's fear, it's grasping, it's competitive in the lower senses of the word. Then level one. Level two, right, you get to true self, I realize I'm not merely a separate self. I don't evolve beyond ego. I evolve beyond exclusive identification with the ego. I realize true self, and that's where most enlightenment conversation stops, and that's its weakness. We, even in the integral space, Ken and I have spent the last 5-6 years, and Rob and I have been doing this for the last 2 years, we've evolved this new idea called unique self, which is beyond true self, right? It's individuality reclaimed at this kind of higher level, right? So we're basically my unique self is the expression, the personal expression of my deepest purpose, kind of post-true self. So in some sense, brand, right, brand is ego, right? In other words, ego is the attempt to kind of make it work for, make me function publicly, effectively. That's my brand, right? So in some sense, John, what you're saying is I've got to move beyond my brand, actually deepen my identity through all the ways you described, and only through this, myriad of deepening activities do I then actually slowly evolve towards, right, the unique self of my higher identity. Does that resonate at all any place, my friends?
Sure.
Something like that.
Well, I mean, what oftentimes goes wrong in corporations is you take the brand and they reify it and they begin to try to manipulate it. So they move away from authenticity. If you view the brand or the collective self that I'm talking about as living, and you and it's an authentic thing. It's not it's not something that you hire marketing people to do advertising around in order to persuade someone about who you are. That's not authentic. That's deceptive. You come out with a new marketing campaign pretending to be something that you may not be and talk about manipulating the brand. I think businesses have gotten off track to the degree it does that. And I think people see through that in a 21st century wired world. We can see that the bullshit that's oftentimes there. And that's one reason people can often be disgusted with business, because they feel like they're being manipulated. And in some cases, they are being manipulated because the authenticity has gone out of it. We need to return to that authenticity, and business needs to get back in touch with its purpose and be authentic, real towards it.
Yeah, no, that's right. And that's the brand functions like ego.
And I just want to point out a really important distinction here, picking up where John just left off, which is the employees feel the same way. Right. I mean, if you're encountering a brand in the marketplace where you say, gosh, you know, I hear their new campaign and I see the brand values they're trying to bring forward, but I just don't feel resonant with that because I have I just don't get that that's who they are in the world. Well, the employees are probably feeling the same way, right? They're saying, gosh, you know, we're advertising all these core values, but that's not the way we act in our management meetings. That's not the way we act as a company. We're constantly putting profit as the only thing, and it's at a zero-sum game mentality. The point is that reality never lies. And so if you want to create a conscious culture and you want to create a conscious brand, you actually have to start with what's real inside the body of the organization itself, because that brand will then emanate outwards through your team, through the core values, into the marketplace, and people will actually feel very resonant with that.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic, Rob. And what you're saying, Rob, and John, what you're saying is, again, we're not – be very careful for our listeners, right? John and Rob are not rejecting brand the same way in the unique self-conversation. We don't reject ego, right? Ego is always a player. It's an important player. But ego is not to be – right? You know, personality is not something I manipulate in order to kind of move forward in the kind of most base levels, right? Personality's got to emerge from the depth of who I am, and brand has to be, right, the public expression of a deep, resonant, living organism, which is, you know, what John called in his particular case, the Whole Foods market self, right, which is alive and growing. And John, I think what you said that was really, you know, very, very resonant for me, and I'm sure for everybody listening, right, is that in some sense you feel that you're serving it, right? You're in service to it. And that, can you ask you to double click for a second? I know that's not an easy question. I insincerely apologize for it in advance, but to give us some of your first-person experience, what's the experience of serving, right, that whole market's collective self?
Well, first thing I want to say about that is that I made this decision to do this a few years ago, so I've made enough money. I stopped taking any money from Whole Foods. I don't take any salary or stock options. In order, I did that because I felt the deeper self call me to do that. But in trying to understand the motivation behind it now, I realize it would be very clear to myself and to other people that I work at Whole Foods to serve it. It's no longer there to serve me.
I've got to interrupt you, John. I apologize for interrupting. Let me just get that again. So you work at Whole Foods, and you don't take now presently stock options or salary from Whole Foods. I got that right.
Right. Oh, that's been 4 years now. So,
wow. That's awesome. That's we can stop the call. That's freaking awesome. That's like unbelievable. That's gorgeous.
Well,
wow.
Thank you, but it reflects the point I'm trying to make, which is that the leadership, it should be servant leadership. It should serve the purpose. And I'm doing it now because it is my deepest purpose in life. I could have left. I could still leave at any time. I mean, there are many interesting things to do in life. But as I've gotten in touch with who I am and what I most care about, what I most love in the world, it's helping Whole Foods to completely fulfill its deepest potential as an organization. So I didn't want there to be any conflict. I strictly want to serve that. And I'm doing so. And as I do it, the paradoxical thing is, as I serve through love the higher purpose of Whole Foods, I am more fulfilled as an individual. It's that paradox of happiness you were talking about. I'm not making that the primary goal. The primary goal is to serve. But paradoxically, as I express love, I am more deeply fulfilled as an individual as well. So I do think it's important that leadership in an organization, if it has to resonate with the deeper, higher purpose of the organization and needs to have wisdom and serve it consciously to the best of his or her ability. I think those are what we need in the 21st century.
That's fantastic. And John, and I just want you to know, if you're ever going to run into financial trouble and you need me to float you a loan, just, you know, I want you to know I'm around, me and Rob.
You were pleading poverty not too long ago.
Right. Well, I was thinking of investing in Whole Foods, you know, after we get off this call. That it's such a fantastic company, so I'm gonna solve that problem for sure by the end of the day. But it really is, you know, one of the things that we've talked about a lot in the integral space in the last couple of years is just to give ourselves permission, you know, to get excited. You know, I'm a big footnotes guy and, you know, big book writer kind of, you know, meta thinker person. But, you know, one of the things I give myself permission is just to get excited. You know, getting excited is not the opposite of sophisticated thinking. So I'm just delighted. I just want to just kind of share that with everyone, just to hear that kind of model, you know, in play. And, you know, Rob's, you know, a number of times talked to me about you, John, in just, you know, really glowing terms. But it just really just it's a delight. You know, we have to kind of be able to delight in each other without being embarrassed. So I'm just delighting in that model and that phrase, right, to serve through love, right, the higher vision of Whole Foods. And Rob, you know, I know that you have, in a not at all dissimilar way, right, you've basically left the world, at least for a time, of venture capital and took the highly not profitable job of CEO of Integral Life and done a fantastic job in kind of, you know, restructuring in a way that it's actually functioning in its day-to-day and at least, you know, delivering the core message. So in your life, Rob, how does this play? How does this serving the higher purpose play?
Well, it's central. Like John, I've never taken salary from Integral Institute. So when I first came on board, it was quite sort of conscious and intentional to be in service to the mission. It was my estimation that it was actually not going to be able to afford for there to be a lot of expense at the Institute. So from a multiple stakeholder point of view, the right conscious leadership decision, in my opinion, was to not do that. So that's really been the case since then. Now a new leader could make a different decision, and I don't think there's any criticism towards that. But yeah, I mean, that's really been the case with both Integral Institute and Integral Life. They've been labors of love, really, labors of love and service.
So you might not be able to participate and be floating John alone, so I might have to take care of that myself, Rob. So I want you to know you're both covered. Okay,
Hey, Mark.
Yes, sir.
There's at least, I know where time is becoming a little bit of an issue for this, and there's two things that I oftentimes find people are confused about that I wanted to kind of address on the whole love and business thing. One has to do with why there isn't, or how can we get more love in the workplace? And I really think there's a kind of a paradigm block or a misconception that is keeping more love from flowing in the workplace. I think it does flow, but it's still not flowing the way it should. And it's because of this belief that love is weak, that we will not be competitive if we act from love, that we will lose in the marketplace. That you got, and if you think about the way oftentimes people think about business or thinks of itself, they use war metaphors. We've got to overpower the competition. We've got to kill them. We've got this idea of macho. You've got to overwhelming firepower. You've got to crush your competitors. Mm-hmm. And the idea being that love is somehow or another for wimps. Love is weakness. Mm-hmm. And I do think that type of thought process, those type of metaphors, really hold back the flow of love in the workplace. And we need leadership to embody that love as they work, and they have to give it permission. People have got to come to understand that that love is not weakness, that love is strength, that love is infuses an organization and allows it to go to higher levels. And I do think that that type of limited thinking is really holding business back. And so I wanted to at least make reference to it.
I apologize, John, for interrupting.
Yeah.
And because this is so important what you're saying, and we're going to make sure we are not going to get off the call right at 20 minutes without hitting the second thing. So I'm holding that. And Rob, I'm going to turn to you in a second, but I just want everyone to hear what John said. I want to double-click with Rob on it because it's so important. If we did nothing else but that in the call, it would be a worthwhile call, right? Love is not weak, right? Love is not an insipid kind of thing that needs to be overcome in order to have this overweening firepower that kind of beats the enemy. So this is what we call, and John, I know that you're deeply, deeply, conversant in this conversation. We would call this from an integral evolutionary perspective, right? Love as, right, the essential initiating energy of the cosmos that actually animates the evolutionary process, right, and drives evolution forward. That's not weak. Not only is it not weak, that's what John's pointing to, right? Love is, right, the primary move towards higher and higher levels, right, of union and integration that actually powers, it's the essential driving energy. If you imagine the energy of a waterfall, just for people listening, that's a pallid approximation out of the driving force of love towards greater integration, towards greater union, beginning at the very cellular level where cells join together, molecules join together to form a larger union of life, up through, atoms to molecules to organisms to organelles to living systems, right? That's what John's describing. And so to actually access the power of love as the evolutionary force, you actually realize that not only is it not weak, but it's the single most powerful force, right, in the cosmos. So I just wanted to highlight that because that is exactly the third, John just pointed to the third person of love just so gorgeously. When I access that in second person and first person, I'm not accessing something which is weak. I'm accessing the strongest force we know. Rob,
Amen, amen. I just want to start. Hallelujah! It's fantastic.
Sing it, brother.
Because I've told CEOs of large companies, look, you're not in this business, you're not in that business, you're not whatever business you think you're in. You're in the love business. And the faster you figure that out, the better leader you'll be, the better your strategy will be, the happier your team will be, et cetera. I mean, the better your financial results will be. And it's because of what you just said. And one of the core values at Integral Life is let the love show. And we specifically sort of articulated what that meant. People want to feel love. They want to give love. And one of the lines we say is this does not make our culture soft. Love is often tough and always clear, right? But it allows us to be authentic, direct, and open with each other. And we mentioned Khalil Gibran's, work is love made visible. It's like, yeah, love is a massive secret hiding in plain sight that much of the business world is still fumbling around with and not quite sure what to do with.
Right.
So here, John.
Yeah. Thank you. And this is so important. And we're allowed to be, for all of our listeners, delighted with you. We're actually allowed to be passionate about these things, right? And we're actually allowed to have I'm gonna bring a bunch of questions to bear. We've gotten a lot of questions on the webcast. But one of the themes in the questions comments is that people are saying, well, wow, we're really enjoying the passion of this conversation. We expected a dry conversation about business. And Rob, I just want to just give you a public compliment. Rob and I together have unfolded the integral spiritual experience and the whole world of unique self, and we've had many conversations where we all didn't always see eye to eye, but we always found a deeper kind of higher, in all our private conversations, a higher place of kind of joint vision of love that actually allowed us to really have just this fantastic run the last couple of years. So I actually know that that's how you live, in private conversation as I've partnered with you, and it's just been a delight. John, the second thing that you wanted to point out to us, which is important in this love business conversation, let's go there.
Competition. A lot of people believe in their current thinking about business and love that they don't understand competition. They think competition, you can't have competition in love, or how can Whole Foods compete with people and still think of itself as a loving company? Competition is the opposite of love. And so I think there's a lot of misconceptions about about competition. Now, of course, competition can be viewed that way, but another way, if we reframe it and we see our competitors as also a type of stakeholder, that our competitors are on they're on a joint quest to make our company better. They are helping us to learn and grow, helping us to evolve. And one of the great things about capitalism is the fact that competition forces us, or we fall by the wayside, to continue to improve, to continue to move upward, to continue to advance. So if we can not think of our competition as something to be afraid of, something to fear, not go into the fear space, but see them on a joint quest for excellence, see them as our, in a sense, partners to make us a better company, which, by the way, is a good way to also think about your critics, of which I and Whole Foods have legion of those, as, in a sense, also helping us to try to improve and to get better. So I do think that the competition is consistent with love, depending on how you frame it and how you think about it. And I've just shared with you how I think about it.
You know, that's completely fantastic, and I just want to share with you, I called Sally Kempton this morning, who's one of the great writers in the country and one of, like, really our great feminine teachers in the integral space, and I said, okay, Sally, what's the one question you think it's important to ask John and Rob? And so Sally said, ask them about competition. Right? That was exactly what she said, and so Sally, who I'm sure is listening, you know, there you have it. So your competitor as a partner, right, your competitor who's kind of calling you right to your highest space, your competitor as part of, you know, the whole larger gestalt that's happening. Rob, a thought on that?
Well, I want to just thank John for his insight on this. I think John is among the leading thinkers in the world on these topics, and so I'm also really appreciating participating in listening to you, John. I think competition is a really interesting thing because it stimulates our state so quickly, right? Even if we're just, forget business competition, just think about our personal lives and how easy it is to get tweaked out of shape with our spouses or with our friends because something is said that sort of puts us into that defensive mode, you know, puts us into that small mind. Sorry, we...
John, I'll bet you that's your battery going out on your phone.
There we go.
We got you. Perfect.
Great. Okay.
Perfect. Go ahead, Rob.
So I mean, we all know that experience. We all know how fast our state can go from one of being somewhat placid to all of a sudden we're contracted and defensive. That's the competitive state. And what I think the analogy here that John's pointing to in the spiritual practice realm is opening the heart in that right when that contraction occurs. Open the heart and say, this contraction is my teacher. What is it here to teach me right now? Right? What can I learn? And what John is pointing out, which I just love, is actually a great spiritual practice individually, sort of expanded to an entire organization.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic, Robin. Let's bring to bear here, you know, back to you, Robin. John, back to you. You know, when we talk about levels of consciousness, we know that everything appears, you know, refracted through its level of consciousness. So when we talk about the Bible, it can appear in a kind of, you know, fundamentalist consciousness which excludes other people, or it can be this very high, you know, biblical, mystical, you know, gorgeous revelation. And I'm sure many, many people in Whole Foods, you know, participate in it. So here's a little Bible coming at you, but, you know, in that kind of highest, deepest sense. When the biblical vision sets up the image of love, right, here's the definition of it. It's kind of awesome. It's Genesis chapter 2. It says that in order to have a person who moves you beyond loneliness and allows you to realize your highest self, the person has to be a competitor. And the actual phrase in Hebrew, right, is ezer kenegdo, a person who supports you and challenges you, competes with you. And if the person, your actual love partner, isn't a person who can actually challenge and in some sense compete you, evoke your competition, right, then actually that person, right, can't call you, right, to your highest self, right, and actually can't move you beyond loneliness. So John, what you're describing is that you actually have a kind of intimacy with your competitor, right?
That's correct. You can view your competitors through fear, or you can view them through the eyes of love. And
yeah,
when you view them through the eyes of love, they are actually helping you to improve and get better.
Yeah, yeah. And that's fantastic. And perhaps in some sense, to throw this throw this, you know, to both of you. Perhaps in some sense the dynamic that happens, and you can describe it from your own first-person experience. I know it in the kind of teacher realm, you know, with fellow teachers. Right? But something that we do with competitors when we're not actually conscious of the contraction, of the coiling, is we actually dehumanize competitors. Right? They cease to love, and they cease to have children, right? And they cease to be vulnerable. They become a kind of it. They're reduced. And so somehow we need to actually let them grow back to their full complex humanity. Does that resonate at all?
Of course. We always reduce what we're afraid of.
Right, right. It's the reduction in fear, right, of what we're afraid of. So this is really, really huge, everyone, as we're moving towards a close, right? That kind of the second point about competition, that I somehow need to view the person who's competing with me as part of my community and even intimate with me and even provoking me, right, to kind of the highest possibility that I can be. Okay, last question. We're going to take two questions, which I've collated, taking, you know, 15, 20 questions, put them into two, right, from the audience. But here's our last question in terms of where we are. Right, love. We've talked about love, and of course we haven't defined it. You know, and in some sense, and John, you pointed this out in the pre-call, you know, when you define love too rigidly, you kill something about love, and yet definition helps. So let's offer this possibility. Right, love not as an emotion at its core, right, but at its core, love is a perception, as a deep seeing of the other. Love is the perception of the unique self. Love is a unique self perception, right, out of which the emotion emerges. So would it be fair to say that, you know, in business, right, which is a kind of new form of church, 50,000, 7,000 people working in Whole Foods are both citizens of their own churches or not, you know, they're dual citizens, and they're citizens of this larger, you know, Whole Foods entity, which they spend much more of their time than they do in any of their religious organizations. So does the sacred obligation of Whole Foods become, right, to love its members, meaning to perceive and to see, right, their unique self and to reflect that back to them and give them the context to live it? But is that a fair, right, kind of, I'm trying to summarize everything you've said and kind of bring it together. Is that a fair reflection of what you've been saying, John?
Yes, but it's too limited in the sense that you only gave membership to the employees of the company, where I think the larger membership are all the customers that trade with us, the suppliers, our suppliers, the communities we're in, our competitors, the media, the government, everything in a sense is connected. The business radiates out and connects to all of these different like spokes from a wheel, we're connected to all of them. So I think you're correct, but I would say that I would expand that beyond just membership for your workers, your employees, your team members, to include all the stakeholders that are connected to the business. Yes, and including the competitors.
Yeah, yeah, emendation received. Rob?
Yeah, it's a great way to think about it, because entrepreneurship is, from a very mystical point of view, entrepreneurship is just being tuned into what reality is ready for next. And what I mean by that is being able to draw together shareholders, employees, and team members, the environmental resources you need, customers, under a shared vision of a higher purpose and around rallying around a set of core values. The entire entrepreneurial effort is knowing that, okay, reality is ready for something new, and I think all of these stakeholders are ready for something new, and they're ready to rally around a new kind of thing.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. I mean, it's the reflection, you know, Rob, that you've done, and John, that you've done, you know, in this call, you know, I'm sure this is going to be downloaded, you know, thousands and thousands of times, and the expansion of how, right, we think about the world of commerce. And the depth of it is just so significant and so important. And, you know, I'm going to be very careful with my language now, because I know it's easy to have, you know, in the wired world, misquotes happen all the time. But actually, the consciousness, John, that you were just describing, and Rob, that you were double-clicking and from your perspective expressing, is really a mystical consciousness. What you've both actually described incarnate in the world of commerce, right, is what the great mystics have talked about throughout the ages, but actually couldn't realize, right, in the real world, which is the invisible lines of connection radiating out, right, between all things that are living in this larger, greater, you know, unity within diversity that's actually becoming incarnate, right, in the world that you're both living, right, and leading. And so in some sense, you're both, you know, if I can say this, both mystics, you know, lived mystics in the world, incarnated mystics. Is that too much, or is that, that sounds a little fair, huh? What do you think?
I'm married to a mystic, so I know what a mystic's really like.
And I have a three-year-old, so you can call me anything.
You can call me any name you want, absolutely. Well, thank you both very, very much. I want to really just, you know, allow myself the privilege of, you know, as I said, you know, 20 minutes of getting excited as we close this call. And I'm going to take one question from the audience. But just what an utterly delightful call, but more than delightful, which really actually is going to be a helpful model, right, for people as we try and look at the next evolutionary unfolding of business. You know, what is it? How does it play? You know, it's just unbelievably important. So I'm going to give you two questions to the audience in our last 2 minutes, right? One, the first one to John, second one to Rob. John, and this is, I'm putting together three or four questions into one, but they all ask essentially as follows. John, do you actually feel, as you conduct business, you know, on particular times during the day, do you actually feel the emotion of love running in you, right, you know, as part of your motive in business? Do you actually, is it a felt experience in your life?
Yes.
A personal question, yes.
Yes, of course. I mean, I feel love, I feel it this very instant. Love is in the moment. We can feel love when we tune in to the moment. Love is present everywhere if we will simply feel it, be into it, feel the presence of it. And so, yes, I do feel it. My goal is to feel it absolutely every instant I'm alive. And I'm not quite there yet, but that certainly is what I'm striving for. But in answer to your question, yes, I feel love much of my life and much of the time at work.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, John. Rob, it's such a great inquiry. I'm actually going to put the same question to you with your permission.
Absolutely. I would echo what John said, and the times I find it most interesting, actually, I'll give you actually a concrete live example. I was in a meeting last week. I was in a discussion with somebody about health and wellness in the United States. We were talking about 10 million people that are in this company's customer base around health and wellness, and we were playing on the whiteboard, and I just kept coming back to not only love for the 10 million people, but the love for the person that was right in front of me, and thinking about his family, thinking about the things that are driving him, thinking about the care and concern he's bringing to the conversation, and surrendering and being in service to that is, I think, it's the most fulfilling part of you know, our time as human beings, I think. So, you know, it's not online for me all the time either, but you know, as I remember to do it, it's definitely part of my practice.
Yeah, thank you very much, John. Thank you, Rob. And I'm gonna finish with a falafel king. A falafel king, falafel is a Mediterranean Israeli food that I'm not sure if you're both familiar with. I don't like falafel, just to kind of
I'm in the food
that.
Business, man. I know
falafel, I forgot. Who am I talking to? Right. Oh, my God. That would be the Jewish definition of chutzpah. Oh, my God. I forgot. So falafel, here we go. So here I am. I don't like falafel, John. That's just between us. Please don't share.
I do.
So here I am in Israel, and I'm dropping off my younger son at summer camp. And the person who was with me, Carrie, says, hey, let's go across the street. Let's get some falafel at the stand. And I kind of looked at her with slight annoyance. I said, you know, honey, you know I don't like falafel. Like, why would we do that? She said, I don't know. Let's just get it anyway. So what can I do? So I cross the street. And I see this little, you know, Moroccan man about 5'1", and he's just glowing. And I'm not sure why he's glowing, but we get a falafel. And as he kind of makes the falafel, I see him kind of completely intent on kind of like every move he's making the falafel, just kind of, he's the high priest in the temple. Like, who is this man? I bite into the falafel, and it is like literally, you know, the taste of the Garden of Eden. Like, I've never tasted anything so good in my life. And I had this kind of almost orgiastic experience, if you will, eating this falafel. I finished the falafel. I turn to him and I say in Hebrew, nu kama zole, right, how much is it? He says, shiva shekalim, 7 shekel. Now, a falafel should cost 15, easy. So I say, well, what do you mean 7 shekel? He says, zemashni tzarich. He says, that's what I need. You know, and I realized, oh my God, this is the high priest in the temple. And this is the falafel priest who is fully investing all of his love and every move. And to everyone listening, right, you just heard a dialogue with two falafel priests, you know, with John Mackey and Rob Smith, who have both really committed their lives to investing their love incarnationally, right? To incarnate it in the real world in all the ways that it plays. And actually, to be in the presence of that kind of love is just an utter, utter delight. So as an old friend of Rob's and a new friend of John's, and John, who's been a great friend to the Integral Movement, you know, for many, many years, Ken, who I spoke to just a little while ago, right, who's recovering now from a difficult week, and he's just kind of beginning to kind of feel great again, and who's just, you know, Ken's just a full incarnation of love in the world. You know, thank you to Rob. Thank you to John. And we look forward to being with you again. Thank you to everybody who's listening. And let love just be integrally alive, you know, in the incarnated lives. Beautiful day to everyone. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, John. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Bob. Bye.
Thank you.